Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll put some context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. Welcome, I'm Jeremy Mags. Coming up on the program today, Washington turns up the heat on South Africa in a new global trade probe. South Africa's maize export hopes fade as global demand softens. Fintech firms push for a bigger say in how South Africa's payment system is run. And a South African startup finds a way to make money from Airbnb's empty nights. It's Tuesday, the 17th of March. Now, Washington has put South Africa in its sights again as the United States opens something called a Section 301 investigation into whether countries, including this one, are doing enough to block imports made with forced labor, a move that could sharpen trade tensions and potentially open the door to tariffs or more tariffs and other restrictions. The probe, as I understand it, was initiated by the U.S. Trade Representative. Stephen Grugd is the head of African Governance and Diplomacy Program at the South African Institute of International Affairs. So let's wade into this with a little bit more detail. Stephen, welcome to you. What exactly is South Africa being accused of?
Well, South Africa is among 60 countries that is being investigated by the U.S. Trade Representative for alleged child labor and use of materials that have or products that have come from child labor into our market, amongst other what the U.S. calls unfair trade practices. So to me, it sounds like an opportunity to find reasons not to import goods from South Africa on top of, as you've said, quite a strict tariff regime, South Africa receiving some of the highest tariffs of any country in the world. So I think Donald Trump seems to have this notion that all his trade partners are getting the better of him. And so it's trying to find reasons to impose more restrictions.
So not really about forced labor at all. It's a wider trade and geopolitical pressure tactic.
That's what I see it as. I mean, you know, child labor or underage labor or legal labor has not really been a big issue in South Africa. So it seems to be a smokescreen or an opportunity for looking at other measures that are considered unfair.
Nonetheless, Stephen, it is going ahead. So how serious would an investigation like this be in practical terms for South Africa?
Well, it depends on what it unearths. And I think that they're going to look hard for what they're looking for. It's not going to put us in a great position with the U.S. As we know, the relationship has been fraying. It's been difficult. We've had the expulsion of our ambassador. We've had the new American ambassador here already demarched. We've had the U.S. boycotting the G20 that South Africa hosted last year. We've had South Africa not being invited to the G20 this year, and a number of other indicators that show that the relationship is not in a good position. This would just be another log on the fire in the rather poor and tattered relationship that we have with the most important economy in the world. So I don't think it's good news.
So those sectors that are maybe standing around this fire, which of those should be most concerned, do you think?
Well, I think it's the same sectors that are getting benefit from getting into the American market through AGOA, the African Growth and Opportunity Act. One point they were saying South Africa may be excluded. That may still happen. But that arrangement has been extended until the end of the year. And the sectors there are the motor industry, the wine industry, and the fresh fruit and agriculture industry, all of which have preferential access into the U.S. market through AGOA, and all of which have been affected by these moves on the trade front.
Is it likely then, and maybe just explain this in simple terms, will this then spill over into AGOA and broader market access then for our exports?
Well, I'm not a trade expert, but I think it will. I think it will have a chilling effect and make it more difficult to get goods into the US market. Maybe that's a good thing because South Africa will diversify and look for other markets as it has been. It's been talking to China for a long time, and as China has granted a whole lot of goods duty-free, quota-free into its market. But it's not so easy to switch markets that easily. I just don't think it's good news for South Africa, and it is going to put those and other industries under a lot of pressure.
So tell me, Stephen, is there a preemptive strategy then that Pretoria could adopt before the April submission deadline?
So we've been told that Pretoria has been trying to secure some kind of trade deal with the US since April last year, and that has not been successful. We know that the US has forged new deals with the European Union, the UK, and others. I think we're just not a priority for Washington at all, and are very far down the list. So I don't know exactly what we could do preemptively, short of trying to find some kind of deal. It also doesn't help that we haven't had an ambassador in the United States since Ibrahim Rasool was declared persona non grata and kicked out of the country. I think it was in January or February. Mm. So it's been a whole year without having our top diplomat in the United States, and that's a problem.
Do you think, bluntly, we're wasting our time here with this mollifying tactic of trying to secure some kind of deal, and that the reality is, as long as the Trump administration and whatever follows continues, that door is now firmly shut and locked?
I don't think we should give up. I think we have to try whatever we can to mend this relationship, to secure markets for our goods, etc. You know, you can't give up on the most powerful country, but boy, it's going to be difficult in the next 3 years as the rest of the Trump administration plays out. And I don't think we should have any illusions.
And mending that relationship, Stephen, and we're moving slightly away here from trade, but it would also mean Pretoria maybe dialing down the rhetoric a little bit.
Well, that's what the U.S. definitely would like to see. You know, South Africa has remained defiant on things like the case against Israel at the International Court of Justice. It says this is a principle about international law and it won't back down. And that's one of the things that Ambassador Bozell, the new American ambassador, has wanted South Africa to do. So it's difficult to see how this is going to play out. But I do think having ambassadors in each other's capitals is really important. And we've suffered from not having that for a year on both sides.
If South Africa mishandles this, and again, the deadline is very close, is there an immediate realistic economic downside, do you think?
I don't know if immediate, but in the medium term, definitely. You know, if the US is then determined that we have unfair trade practices, it can take a whole number of measures, including stopping imports, that will just really damage the economy. Now, you know, there's some that say that, oh, we don't need America, and they've got a right-wing president in the White House, and we must do our own thing, and we must look to BRICS. Not so easy. Especially with the historical relationship we've had with the U.S. and the size of the imports that go into the United States from South Africa.
And to that end, this is more than a warning shot. It's the start of what is obviously a much tougher U.S. line on South Africa. What might come next, do you think?
Well, we've heard in Congress for the last maybe a couple of years, I suppose, that there is legislation slowly making its way through requiring a full review of the US's relationship with South Africa, in all aspects. And if that goes through and that investigation comes up and says, well, South Africa is not acting in the US interests, again, I think that could tear the relationship even further apart and make any kind of reset just that much more difficult.
Stephen Grouge, thank you very much indeed. Head of the African Governance and Diplomacy Program at the South African Institute of International Affairs.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
On now to the agricultural economy. In South Africa's maize export season is running out of road, it seems, with exports sitting at around 1.7 million tonnes against a 2.4 million tonne forecast for the 25-26 marketing year. That ends in April, so just around the corner. The problem, as far as I understand it, is not supply at home necessarily, but softer global demand. That is obviously raising tough questions about export markets, pricing power, and what this means for farmers and the wider agricultural economy. Let's put all of that to Wandile Sihlobo, who is chief economist at AgBiz. Wandile, welcome. Why then is South Africa likely to miss this maize export target? What's the problem here?
Jeremy, what we are seeing is extremely weak demand than usual in the various parts of the country. Ordinarily, we will be seeing that countries in the African continent will be showing a lot of interest on our products around this time. But this year, we aren't seeing that. And the reason for it is because we are emerging from a reasonably good agricultural season across the Southern Africa region. And I think that has lessened the amount of maize that we would typically export to some of the countries in our region. But at the same time, Jeremy, there was a lot of maize in the world market because we're not only exporting to Africa. I'm thinking here South Korea, Japan, Vietnam are some of the markets we export to, even as far as Italy. But this time around, the maize demand from these countries was fairly weak, and I think that they've been buying maize from South America, the US, and the other region that perhaps maybe was way cheaper than where we are sitting as a country.
Which tells me, Wandile, or at least suggests, that our forecasts were too optimistic.
I would say our forecasts were too optimistic, but they were based on what's available. Because, Jeremy, we had a good crop last year. I mean, you and I know that South Africa consumes about 12 million tons of maize. And if you think about what we had last year, we had about 16.7 million tons of maize, a record, second largest crop on record. And we are even looking at the current season that we are in, which is a crop that will only be harvested from May. We are expecting a crop of around 16.1 million tons, which again, is still really a super large crop. So I think on the basis of this, it was fair to estimate that we have that surplus. But again, I would concede and say from a demand perspective, we were perhaps too optimistic that there would be many people knocking in our doors and saying, hey, I want South Africa's high quality maize as they've done in the past, but it hasn't been in that way so far.
So a tough call for farmers then, because weaker prices, which might come, means more margin pressure for local farmers. And Wandile, in many respects, they can ill afford that.
It's very difficult, Jeremy, and I use the word very, tend to be careful with language, because if you think about it, last year, we were already starting to see input costs creeping up. I'm talking fertilizer, fuel prices, and all of those things. Usually, you would hope then that if the prices on the selling side of the commodities are higher, you are able to cover a bit of that. But right now, the farmers from around about October, September, they will have to prepare for the next season. And I think that the financials from this year perhaps were not as that good. Because if you and I can just open the screen now, we look at maize prices. They are down today, March 17, by roughly 4% white maize from a year ago. Yellow maize is down by roughly 20%. But if you think about the fertilizer price, as well as what we are expecting on the fuel prices as a result of the events we are observing in the Middle East, it does look like they will be going to another season with far higher input costs than where we are coming from at a time where the selling price for their commodity is not as attractive. So the margins indeed, to your point, are pretty much under pressure at the moment.
So the slower exports, I imagine, leaves us with excess local stock. That obviously is going to distort the domestic market. So what happens to that maize that we've got sitting in silos?
I would say, Jeremy, not so much distort per se, but all I would say is that if you are now sitting in South Africa on a consumer side, at least things are not as bad, which is why, I mean, I put out a tweet earlier today, March 17, as I was observing the business day, leading with a story on its front page about how food prices may increase notably given the expected fuel prices, to say, hey, yes, fuel is intensive in our distribution of the food products, but let's remember that the commodities are under pressure. So in a way, that cushions the domestic consumer to a certain extent over the near term. But what worries me now is that when you look into 2017, it does appear that the weather conditions may switch from the La Nina rains that we have enjoyed to more normalization El Nino. And I think that in that path, then, the demand for maize may again start to firm up in 2017. So yeah, in 2027. So right now in the near term, pressures, but I think that if we are able to store all of this and keep it in good conditions, when we go into later this year and also thinking about next year, the demand will revive. So we are in a temporary blip in a way, if I could put it in that way.
Is there anything that government and the wider maize industry then should be doing differently to diversify demand, or if there is an opportunity to build more resilient export channels?
I would go with the latter, building more export markets, which is part and parcel of our export diversification approach, is always a preference for me. And I think that we need to continue on that particular path as what we will be doing. We are building export markets in the Middle East, in Asia. And I know that in the Middle East, people will tend to be negative because of the current war, but it's an attractive market for long-term growth. The war will be over at some point. So let's continue with that. But at the same time, in the greater Asia and the other markets, and make sure that we open as many export markets as we can. The African continent also remains very important, Jeremy. Nearly half of our agricultural exports go to the African continent. And I think that as long as we touch base and we keep active in these markets, that will help. And of course, being vigilant on the input costs so that there's not a bad behavior by those that are given that everyone knows that everyone is expecting input cost prices to increase. So it's really all of those things. But I wouldn't encourage any intervention or any policy change on anything except us going out there promoting our high quality products in a range of export markets.
The conundrum, of course, is that the surplus is global, so other countries are doing exactly the same thing, or should be doing the same thing as South Africa is doing, which means that we need greater supply chain efficiency. And let's be honest, there are log jams, there are blocks within our system, are there not?
There are some log jams, or I would say there were, but now South Africa has a new economic diplomacy strategy, which begins to say, even on foreign affairs, the tone is changing to favor more the exports. We are probably going to be hearing a lot more about it from those that are charged with foreign affairs issues. But also within the export side, I think that if we can capacitate the DTIC even more with the staff on the export branch, that would help us a little bit. And in our ports, I would say we've struggled with some of the ports like Cape Town and the others. But in the grain side, Bidvest and the others that run the grain terminals, I think they do a superb job alongside, of course, with the Transnet in a Durban port, which is a major export port for us. I think there, Jeremy, things are not as that bad. But all we need to do is to continuously promote the high quality product that comes out of South Africa. Many people have maize, but few people have their maize dried out by the sun and of quality as South Africa. The United States farmers know that we have better quality than them.
Wandile Sihlobo, thank you very much indeed. Chief Economist at Agbiz.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, South Africa's fintech payment industry, I read, is moving from disruptor to policy player, with the Association of South African Payment Providers expanding from 8 to 15 members in its first year and taking on, it says, a far more visible role in debates over regulation, payment costs, access to infrastructure, and the future of real-time digital payments. The association says it's been engaging on everything from the National Payment System Bill and interchange reform to PaySharp, Cloud Rules and Treasury's Financial Inclusion Forum. I want to talk now to Lincoln Mali, who's president of the Association of South African Payment Providers. Lincoln, welcome. Why have you decided that you need a louder collective political and regulatory voice right now? What's driving this process?
Jeremy, thanks for having me. The first reason is that there's been so much innovation and disruption by non-banks or fintechs over the last 10 or 15 years. New organizations founded on dealing the inefficiencies that we have today in the payments environment. And these organizations, like the Ecocas of this world, the Yokos of this world, the, you know, Shop2Shop, all of them have kind of been born out of seeing the challenges, and they've done very well. Yet they were not speaking with one voice. And so there was a need to say, could we not create a common voice that could be powerful so that we are also in the tables around where policies are being created? So we started having a conversations with the CEOs of these organizations and said, guys, we are competitors. We'll be fierce competitors for a long, long time. Yet there is scope and room for us to collaborate on how we can shape the payment landscape of South Africa for generations to come. The second reason was there were changes that were taking place in other markets like Brazil, like India, where the payment system was being opened up to non-banks. And so we wanted to be a voice to engage the South African Reserve Bank to say, we think that South Africa could do much better than we're doing now in creating a much more open, dynamic and competitive payment landscape.
Is there an argument that says traditional banks are moving too slowly to support real competition and innovation? Is that what you're saying?
I would say it's nuanced. I would say that in the different markets we've seen, there's been a displacement of cash and more digital uptake. Two, there's been a displacement of transactions from traditional banks to fintechs. And thirdly, sometimes with banks, you have the protection of existing revenue pools that might limit incumbents from adopting some of the innovations that need to come because they are shareholders to account to, with those shareholders expecting returns, but those returns are on old profit pools that may be displaced in the future. So we wanted a dynamism that would be added to the conversation by those who don't have a lot of profit pools to protect, to say, what are the customers wanting for the future, whether they be merchants or consumers? And that's how we've been able to enter into the conversation. So our stance is not an anti-bank stance. It's about what does a future fit payment landscape look like? And therefore, the regulatory environment must enable fintechs to play on an equal playing field with traditional banks. And that's been our focus.
So what specific regulatory barriers then that are making it harder for non-bank payment providers to grow need to be removed?
So the first and most obvious one is that in terms of the current regulation and laws, you as a fintech cannot provide end-to-end payment services without the sponsorship of a bank. And that is a huge barrier because you are dependent on a competitor to sponsor you into the payment system. So we were arguing that in other jurisdictions, the regulatory environment has been changed to enable fintechs or non-banks to fully participate without requiring the sponsorship of a bank. That the Reserve Bank has also championed. We've added our voice, and I think in the coming months, you will see new regulations that create that opening up of the playing field. The second one is we think that the costs of transactions have to be brought down. There had to be a review of the interchange so that more consumers and more merchants, particularly in township villages and inner cities, can fully participate in the payment system, and we drive the economy to grow much faster. The third one is around wonderful initiatives like PaySap are restricted to the banking environment. They are not opened up to non-bank or fintechs. And for those fintechs to enable this to be in POS devices, in small businesses, in townships, in villages, that will really scale, PaySap more. And the last one is to enable much more fair and transparent competition that doesn't enable traditional players to use their current position to hold clients that may want to migrate to a fintech. So those are the regulatory things that we've put on the table with the Reserve Bank and other banks.
The difficulty, of course, is as you push for more fintech access, you've got to be very careful not to create new risks around stability, consumer protection, and fraud.
Absolutely. And that's exactly why we thought that coming together will enable the conversation to be more nuanced. Because, as I said, it's not bank versus non-bank. It's saying, what is the right regulatory framework that has worked in other jurisdictions where both banks and non-banks, or fintechs and telcos and retailers, are participating in the payment system? And therefore, the rules and regulations around customer protection, around fraud prevention of money laundering, protection against cybercrime, are both agreed with all the role players. So these organizations that started ASAP are very serious organizations that already have these in their own businesses. So these were not fly-by-nights. So now we've moved from 8 organizations to 15 fintechs that say we want to be part of this. So if the regulator wants to put capital requirements, of course, tell us what those are. If you want to say the people in charge of these businesses must fit and proper, put that regulation. So we've engaged on those things so that we don't have an abstract conversation that presupposes if you're a bank, you are for your risk management, and you're a fintech, you're not. Because right. I think that conversation becomes quite secular. But once we start to put what those mitigants are, you can see then businesses saying, I'm in. I am prepared to abide by those rules, and I'll participate.
Lincoln Marley, thank you very much indeed. President of the Association of South African Payment Providers.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Let's move on to an entrepreneur on the show, and I think you're going to love this one. Millions of nights in Airbnb properties around the world, as I understand it, sit empty every year between bookings. For hosts, those gaps in the calendar, I imagine, represent lost income as well as wasted inventory. Now, a South African travel tech startup believes those unused nights can be turned into some kind of global travel currency. Durban-based platform Airhost Swap allows Airbnb hosts to convert unbooked nights into points that can be redeemed for stays in other properties around the world. Effectively, as I understand this, and I hope I'm getting it right, turning spare capacity into travel opportunities. The platform already connects thousands of properties globally and taps into a growing home exchange market, and it's estimated to be something in the region of $5.5 billion. Well, I'm going to talk now to Lamont Hitchings, who is the founder and chief executive officer of Airhost Swap. Lamont, great idea. Let's start with the basic problem that you're trying to solve. How big is the issue of unbooked nights?
Jeremy, thanks for having me on your show. It is a big issue because occupancy of Airbnbs globally at the moment is sitting at around 55%, which obviously that's almost, you could almost say at 50%, which means every second night is not being used. So in a month of 30 days, 15 of those nights are unused. And we have thought of putting this platform together in order to actually make use of those empty nights. On average, in South Africa, the occupancy is sitting at even lower than that, 29 to 49% occupancy. So, yeah, so that's, we saw that an opportunity to turn those unused nights into travel opportunities. So instead of empty nights sitting there unused, hosts can stay in other hosts' properties around the world using our host point system, which actually enables them not to have to swap like for like at another property, because that, you know, takes away your choice and flexibility. With our host point system, you can bank those points and then use them to go and stay somewhere else. You don't have to stay at the person who decides to come and stay at your property.
So, Lamont, hosts effectively are sitting on unused value, and often they haven't realized this until you guys came along.
Yeah, correct. I mean, they'll try and discount their nights to try and get bookings in, but that often doesn't work because, those nights will stay, they'll remain empty. And especially towards the current date. So in other words, the last 5 days or so to the current date. So for example, on a Thursday, if they haven't got their bookings in for the weekend, those aren't going to happen. That property is going to remain empty. But now with our network, you know, the Airbnb owners can then, they can broadcast to other people on our network to say, listen, we've got empty space. Do you want to come and stay at our property? They then earn their points. And they can bank them and then obviously go and use them somewhere else.
Lamont, there's got to be a brilliant origin story to this idea. Where were you sitting and how did you come up with it?
Yeah, Jeremy, I've been involved in Airbnb. Well, I wouldn't say Airbnbs because it was before Airbnb was around, but we had guest houses and those properties. And we often had empty nights. And I don't know how it came to me, but we thought of the concept. Took a long time to actually to realize it. It's taken a long time to put the platform together. But I think we are there, and we've done a lot of sort of fine tuning, extra features, and so forth to make it viable and get the usage out of it from the owners.
And tell me, technologically, how difficult was it to set the platform up?
We went through a stage where we used a tech company in India to start the process up, and what they were using just wasn't good enough. And we built the platform. It just wasn't fast enough. It wasn't doing what we needed it to do. So we actually re-engineered the whole platform from the ground up and did it here. I don't know if you've been on there, but it's fast. It's fast in global terms. We've got a built-in messaging system, so hosts can talk to each other on our platform. It's all secure. It's like having a built-in WhatsApp system on the platform itself. So they don't need to go into WhatsApp and talk to each other. They can talk on our platform. And we also have our apps are going to be published on both the App Store and the iOS Store, probably in the next week or so. We had them before, and like I said just now, we've re-engineered the back end. So we're reconnecting those onto the new app.
You're launching, Lamont, from South Africa into a very competitive global market. How difficult is it for a local startup to compete in the global travel tech space, which I imagine is dominated by US and European companies?
Yeah, Jeremy, I think we come from a country that's, is a travel country, South Africans travel around in their own country. So, we got beautiful destinations. We've got, the Garden Coast, Garden Route. We've got Cape Town. We've got all over the Western Cape. We've got the game reserves. So there's a lot of travel and we've got experience. We've come from that. We've come from a travel sort of background country. So we know how to cope with competing with Americans and Europeans and so forth.
How difficult was it to take the idea and then turn it into a funding reality?
Well, so far we've actually used our own funding. So
risky, eh?
It is risky. But we've got to the stage now where we need to obviously get funding, and that's probably going to be our next step.
How difficult do you think that's going to be to do?
Well, we've got people using the platform already, so we've got a bit of usage out of the platform. So to go to funders now, we've got 2,700 users using the platform now, with about 3,000 listings. So in a very short space of time. So I don't think we've got to the place where we're going to go and try and get funding right now. I think it's too soon. go for funding at a later stage.
I like the fact that you use that phrase big time. Just a final question then, Lamont. What does big time or end goal success look like for your startup?
Oh, Jeremy, yeah, there are 8 million Airbnb listings globally. So the market is huge. I mean, we're the only platform that's focusing on Airbnb owners and hosts. So if you do your calculations, 1% of that figure is 80,000 properties on our platform. So yeah, we've got a long way to go to get to that stage, but the market is there. It's a sizable market to capture.
I wish you nothing but success. We always love a good entrepreneurial story on this program. I've been talking to Lamont Hitchings. He is the founder and the chief executive officer of the platform Air Host Swap. Lamont, good luck and thanks very much. And that's our program for today. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.